back to another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This one is on the housing sector, and we've got a few special guests this week, including Charlotte Hogg, our consultant, and Becky Tucker from House of Risk. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
It was a great session, don't you think?
It was a really good session today.
Yeah, great to be able to have the opportunity to circle back around, I think, around that, you know, the piece that we did for part one back in November. And how much has changed since then to come full circle to part two.
Definitely. And we had a couple of other special guests, Paul and Kieran, from Decision Time. So we brought them in as well, and discussed, you know, how software can really help with risk management. And then especially in the housing sector, you know, the issues that we face, or that the housing sector faces, and how to mitigate those. So would you like to tell us a little bit more about that?
So Decision Time of are, as you say, they're our gold sponsors for Housing GRC, so really key actually in the conversation that we're having around the governance, risk and compliance topics more generally. And how we join those dots. We spoke a lot today in the session around that golden thread in the organisation and the importance of that and the tone at the top as a result of that golden thread, and how we run that data through our organisations in a safe and secure way.
Definitely. So it's tied in really nicely with the conference that we've got coming up soon. You know, this is Decision Time will be joining us then. It was a great session.
A really good session.
So without further ado, we should move on to the session itself. I hope you all enjoy it. The links that we discussed in the podcast will be on our website, I believe, Miles. So if you are listening back, you can find them there. Also, the Data Protection Housing LinkedIn forum, you can access that through the website as well. So I hope you all enjoy the show, and thank you both for joining me on the session.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad that you can all join us again today. The session last time had so much interaction. It was amazing to have so many people in the room just discussing all of those nitty-gritty bits of the housing reform bill. So I'm really happy that we're doing a part two today, and I'm hoping today is just as chatty, so feel free to interject as and when you want to. But over to you, Becky.
Thank you, Char, and I concur. We do like to hear from you, so even if it's in the chat and you don't want to go on camera, then absolutely join in. We like to chat. So hello everybody. So those of you that don't know me, I'm Becky Tucker. I'm director and founder of a risk consultancy business called House of Risk. But aside from that, I'm actually from the sector. So I've got a long 13 years history of working in risk and audit and compliance with the sector. And I'm very passionate about all this stuff. And I'm so delighted to be back today, back on the podcast. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, guys. It's always lovely to be chatting to such like-minded people, I think. So I can't believe that it was actually back in November that we did part one of this. In between that, we've had like Christmas and loads of things going on. But actually, part two for us is here already. And we promised back in part one that we would do this. So I'm chuffed that we're able to. We explored loads of the kind of potential risks, if you like, that we were looking forward, not looking forward to, but looking forward to, if you know what I mean, from a calendar perspective into 2023, all of those things that were going to kind of be impacted by the housing reform. And goodness, since then, so much has been in the news and so much has changed that we're absolutely going to be picking up on today. We're continuing that conversation to discuss all the challenges and all of the opportunities, I guess, associated with managing risk in the housing sector at this particular time. This session comes for us in the lead up to our Housing GRC conference, our Governance, Risk and Compliance conference. So many of you will have seen already, because we're not quiet about it, that on the 18th of May, we're going to be having a housing conference And the very reason why today we have some very friendly guests with us. So Decision Time are one of our gold sponsors for the Housing GRC conference. So we thought it would be really nice for them to come along and say hello and tell us a bit about what they do. So welcome to you both. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much. Delighted to join. Really excited.
Feel free really to introduce yourselves.
Yeah, Paul, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm Paul McSorley. I am a governance, risk and compliance software specialist at Decision Time. I look after English housing and all of the not-for-profits.
Hi guys, I am Kieran McCann. I'm head of sales in Decision Time. Hate that sales terminology. I suppose being from Ireland or Northern Ireland, the more romantic term is a matchmaker. So I'll go with that. So I have been working in digital transformation now for 13 years. In education, democratic services, and most recently in governance in the last 6 months. So I'm actually here today on a learning expedition and pretty much to find out from the DPP. And as Becky said, we partnered with the House of Risk. So it's, I'm here more for the learning. So I'll be asking probably more questions than anybody else.
Fabulous, thanks. Do you know, every time I hear that word expedition, all I can think of is Winnie the Pooh. Sorry, that just took me right back to that moment in time. I just love it. Brilliant. Thanks, guys. It's really, really good to have you here. We'll make you work for the session. So we'll be pulling you in and getting your view of the world as well, which is great. In the meantime, I think it would probably be useful for us to kind of have a look at some definitions. So we've already started to introduce some things like GRC. And for many people in the call that are not kind of that risk world, but more the data people, I thought it might be useful for us to just explore what we mean by GRC. In the sector, more currently at the moment, GRC is a huge thing, and that is driven very much by the regulator. We're all seeing that kind of, you know, get your data quality right, get your data talking to each other across the business. So governance, risk and compliance related to the housing sector is kind of a key theme for us today. Very much about joining the dots, as I like to call it, or the more formal term golden thread, which we'll look at in a bit. Essentially, governance refers to that system of rules that we've all got in our organisation, the practices that we follow through and processes that we stay in line with. And I guess that sort of encompasses all the structures and policies and procedures that guide our decision making, our accountability, our risk management. And then the R in our GRC is absolutely around the risk, as you might guess. So this refers to something that may get in the way of our organisational objectives. Quite a lot of the time we're talking about risk from a strategic perspective rather than that kind of day-to-day operational piece. And many of you will see top ticket items around data on your risk registers at the moment. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely good and proper. And then that kind of final piece around GRC, the C is compliance. And that's the bit that really impacts on our session today, because that's the bit that the regulator are really waving a stick at us with. And quite rightly so. I can't argue with that in many instances. And we're absolutely going to be exploring that. So absolutely watch this space. One of the things that I'm really excited to be working on actually with the Decision Time is around a better solution for corporate assurance statements. For many of you, you'll probably know corporate assurance statements are where we provide our kind of our position to the board around our compliance and how assured they can feel that we're kind of ticking all those boxes. So that really kind of fits in quite nicely. Sure. Last time we talked about some risks in the social housing sector, didn't we?
We did.
We looked at the kind of the financial risks around the, you know, changing government funding and that cost mm-hmm. of living piece and really the bit that's impacting on our tenants, but also on our employees. You know, mm-hmm. from I know at the moment I'm working with an organisation where we're looking at the, you know, the employee salary increase for the year, which is always a challenge. And absolutely, you know, we're seeing so many organisations that are going on strike as a result, and you know all the impacts that's having as well. So huge top ticket item, not just for our residents, but also for our employees as well. And then the kind of usual themes. We spoke about health and safety risks around that kind of building and fire safety issues that we're seeing and the well-being of our residents. There's so much around reputation. We could literally go on, couldn't we, forever around that reputation piece, around the damp and mould stories and, you know, really horrific outcomes that we've seen over the last year or so. In terms of the risks, then we'll kind of explore those a little bit more, looking at the kind of risk management framework piece, I suppose, and how that impacts on us in terms of that piece. So I'm just going to ask a question of you guys, our guests for today, so Paul and Kieran. How do you think that, given all of that kind of backdrop that we're in at the moment, that technology support that you offer, as opposed to referencing back to Kieran's sales piece, not about sales, but more about how does it support risk management? What is it that you do that you think adds value to the sector?
So Kieran, do you want me to take that one?
I think Paul, yeah, you're this is your specialty, so yeah, please.
Yeah, so I think technology already provides a leading role within risk management in the housing sector. We're already using a lot of data analytics tools to identify, assess the risks, monitor and report on risk mitigation as well. So it's not anything new. It's not anything revolutionary. It's already there. Where we come in at Decision Time, we try to bring these kinds of legacy processes into the 21st century and to simplify the process with our solutions.
Just on this again, this is I don't know if this is the forum to do it, but Paul is actually a really good Pinocchio analogy for that, so Paul, if you wouldn't mind.
So I call it the Pinocchio effect. So we take things like spreadsheets, things that are very rigid, very sterile, we look to animate them, breathe a little bit of life into them, make them a little bit more responsive, flexible. So that means that it's not just for the risk management team, it's for the individual risk owners as well. So we take all of those spreadsheets and turn them into a real boy, essentially.
So first we've had Winnie the Pooh, and now we move on to Pinocchio. The challenge next.
All the Disney themes can we get in this session?
I think I'll take off the Dumbo box here, folks.
Oh, that's not true.
That's my wife would disagree, Becky, but I will.
Yeah, and I think just in terms of what the system actually does, or indeed what risk management systems should do in general, is to just really simplify those processes. They shouldn't just be for risk experts within an organization. We should be able to take things and condense them down so that they're tangible, comprehensible for individual risk owners. We do say it all the time, you are trying to monitor your risks, you are trying to report on them. The technology that we introduce should be here just to facilitate that, rather than introducing something that's too complex and ultimately won't be adopted within the sector.
I mean, it's a central area as well, isn't it? You know, keeping control over that helps. So, yeah, it's useful.
I'm sure, again, the problems you guys face and that constantly comes up in regards to data is, what data do you keep? You know, what's good data, what is relevant data? So I suppose that again, just in the housing association, I'm sure they're getting hit with so much data that they're probably thinking, what I keep here, what I use, what I analyze, what I make decisions on. I suppose Becky, and you're an expert, like what is the best way to approach that?
I think that ultimately it's about making sure that you've got a line of sight, isn't it? So Whether you've got a system to do that or not, really, for me, it's about making sure that you're joining those dots so that you know that the data quality around your asset is feeding through to your insurance program, that's feeding through to your risk register, that you're really understanding from a performance perspective. So, you know, I see very many times on performance indicators in an organization, it talks about, you know, where you are with the program of regeneration, where you are with the program of maintenance on your properties. And all of those indicators should be telling us stuff. I found it really interesting last year. I think it was about November, December time, actually. Chief executives were all written to by the regulator around damp and mould. And actually, all of a sudden we were all on it, like, you know, like something crazy in the sector. Everybody was suddenly scrabbling around trying to find data on their assets around, you know, the condition of their assets. And then have we had complaints about that before? What does that look like? You know, have we had a run on complaints around damp and mold in the past? And what about our right first time repairs? And, you know, have we been back again after, you know, going in and solving some damp issues within that property? So I suppose the point I was getting to there is it took for the regulator to point a stick at us to say, you know, we need to sort out the damp and mould, guys. What do you know about your damp and mould for us to actually do it? Now, in some organisations, they were absolutely on it. For many organisations, they absolutely were not. And we had to have all these new measures. And now all of a sudden I see damp and mould working groups in organisations that I'm working in, and, you know, all of those things. And you start to think, well, actually, why do we need a specific damp and mould group? You know, what is it about that that tells us we need a separate working group around that? Instead, you know, we should have that data at our fingertips and we should be managing our properties effectively.
No, that takes me back actually to when I was a student living out, and so someone that I used to live with, they had issues of damp in their room and mould. And the way that the landlord resolved that was by giving them a dehumidifier.
I had the exact same thing when I was at uni as well.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. And then they ended up taking that dehumidifier back a month or two later to give it to somebody else, and just didn't really resolve the issue until we moved out. So, yeah, I think it is important to for reform in that area.
I agree. I think it's really interesting from the point of view that lots of properties that were built in the 50s and 60s, that kind of post-war property boom that we had to have to, you know, service the properties that had been bombed or whatever during the war, and the population increase as well post-war, that suddenly we had a massive amount of our properties that we're now dealing with today built, that weren't built with the today's kind of living examples that we needed to have within them. So, you know, suddenly we've got cost of living crisis. So people don't necessarily, you know, can't afford to tumble dry their clothes anymore. They're drying them in their living room. And, you know, it all contributes towards that. But then we put brilliant double glazing in and seal in all the moisture. So, you know, we are absolutely a victim of today's kind of living conditions, as well as some, you know, some poor property stock. And that's no two ways about it. We can't just blame the, what is it, lifestyle was the kind of buzzword a few years ago, wasn't it? It's the resident, it's the lifestyle that they lead. Not necessarily.
No, exactly. And I think when there was such a big push on, you know, developing X amount of new properties per year, I think that the current stock got forgotten about and unfortunately got left behind. And, you know, we've seen in recent months that it's led to some quite catastrophic cases. Mm. So I think it's always that worst case scenario that then pulls us back to look at what we actually need to do with our current stock. So I am glad in that sense that, you know, although it's come from a very negative place, it's going to do, you know, it's going to do better for all of social housing residents and, you know, residents in general that are renting from a private landlord.
Yeah, I think in line with that, there's the headache of disrepair claims as well.
Oh, though, absolutely.
Absolutely rife at the minute, and only increasing. It's just, it's non-stop. And, you know, within that, obviously, we come into it from a data protection standpoint where information, you know, personal data is requested. We've been seeing loads of SARs coming at the minute. I feel like I'm having the same conversation with a lot of my customers as well.
Me too.
I think everybody's in the same boat. You know, a lot of people are receiving letters or emails from solicitors, no win, no fees, you know, about disrepair claims and so on. We had one yesterday, actually. I'm going to share my screen with you, if I can find it. So this is all of the information that was requested as part of a disrepair claim. Not all of it relating to personal data, but it just baffled me. that they're expected to receive to collate all this information and provide it. So let me know when you can see my screen.
Yeah, we've got
We can.
Yeah.
So we absolutely can, Jazz. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's mad.
That's an absurd amount of data.
It is.
Crazy.
I think a lot of people are in the same boat with this. I know everyone's got the cameras off listening in, but there'll be a lot of nodding heads, I'm sure.
And just to jump in, I think, Becca, you and I both attended the NatFed Audit and Risk Conference, and
yes,
most of Jonathan Walters from the regulator, was around investing in systems and data. With all the issues that you've discussed there, do you think that better systems and better data would address a lot of the issues?
Yes.
Well, yes, I think that from the perspective of that data subject et cetera piece that Jazz has just put up on screen there, yes, if we could, a touch of a button, just get that data in a really, really simple format that's, you know, a readable format for somebody to just be able to kind of access, then, oh my gosh, what a utopia that would be for every data protection team in every housing association out there.
It would be amazing. Becky knows the headaches that I went through whilst we worked together with me doing all of the SARs. It was, some of them in particular, were my worst nightmare.
Yeah, totally agree. And also the, you know, how confident are we that we are, when we think we are providing all of that data, actually doing so? You know, in many ways, you can understand a kind of no win, no fee lawyer coming up with a list like that. That's probably their stock list now, Jazz, and they're probably wheeling that out for every claim that they're dealing with, unfortunately. Uh-huh. So, you know, we should be taking a screenshot of that and getting ready for it, because I just think that's, you know, that's the way forward, really. I want to know
as well. Sorry. You know, some people, they're not even aware that, you know, the solicitors are requesting this information on their behalf. We had one customer where, you know, they took extra steps to confirm the authorization for a subject access request as part of this, and the individual didn't even know about it. So I don't know if they continued with it afterwards, but you know, it's worth double checking.
You see that quite often, in all honesty.
I spot that question come through from James there. Look, so James, what structures and processes do you have in place to manage installation of CCTV, ring doorbells, etc.? I think this is a really, really key issue. One that we've certainly in the past seen, haven't we, Shah? Mm-hmm. And we had guidance in place for both for the housing management team. For when they are approving, bear in mind approving that people can have those pieces of equipment, particularly around CCTV, because the data protection issues and the responsibilities lie with them, exactly, as well as with the landlord. And then guidance for the residents themselves to make sure that you can, you know, when they're asking, can they have these things installed? You know, if you're talking about, and presumably you are talking about their own CCTV, because you've mentioned ring doorbells as well, that actually having some guidance to say this is what's acceptable, and this is what you need to consider. Andrew's commented, so we have put in place, yes, the ICO guidance on this is excellent as well. Definitely.
I think it's really important to consider that accountability piece as well. You know, what are you doing internally to address that situation? Do you have a managed CCTV asset register? Do you have a complete DPIA folder for each different scheme or property or whatever where CCTV may be, you know, being implemented, etc.? So it's about considering how you're documenting and understanding where that is located, because I know quite often some of my clients come to me, they go, oh, we found this CCTV at this block of flats, we had no idea it was there, don't know how long it's been there for, don't know why it was installed. So it's just about understanding how we can sort of alleviate that.
I would err on the side of caution with when it comes to ring doorbell as well, because you don't want to claim responsibility for that, for any tenants that install ring doorbell, because you don't have any oversight onto what they're collecting.
Exactly.
So it's best to, in my opinion, it's best to take a approach of refusing, you know, individuals to install that, because you don't want to accept responsibility for it.
Exactly.
And again, having that in policy is...
It'd be down as their discretion. They're the ones that need to register with the ICO. It's their data. Exactly. It wouldn't be the landlords.
Yeah.
And that's about being really clear in your guidance, isn't it, to make sure that they are aware, because most people wouldn't be in the least bit aware that they'd have a responsibility to register with the ICO as a single occupant in a property that it just doesn't cross people's minds, does it, at all?
James has said here, something which is often overlooked is the necessity to review installation too. And he said that he agrees in social care, they facilitate installation, but they don't run the systems.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of that whole piece then, I suppose, just reflecting back on that data subject access request, Paul, Kieran, how do you think that kind of golden thread can run through the organisation? You kind of pushed the question back to me almost, but how do you think, you know, systems like yours and others, you know, how do we join the dots with that?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question, Becky. I suppose, Paul, if you don't mind, I'll take the first part on, I suppose, giving the audience a breakdown of what the golden thread is, and then I suppose with your expertise you can apply it to the housing association. Would that work?
That works for me, yeah.
So I suppose my brain needs to simplify things to understand it. So I relate the golden thread to weaving, in effect. The area that me and Paul are from, Mid Ulster, is actually quite famous for it. So weaving involves keeping the thread as straight and as undamaged as possible in order to ensure that the kind of the quality of what you're making is at a high standard. So each bend, twist, cut in that thread reduces the quality of the weave delivered at the end of the process. Those weaves, those bends and twists and cuts in real life are risks. So the theory behind the golden thread of governance is that stakeholders across housing associations will have accessible, reliable, up-to-date and accurate information, I suppose, but that data will be made available. It's transparent and honest, and then decisions can be made to help the headline objectives. So it's pretty much joining up everything that would come from a board meeting, tying that into the risks then, as Jasmine just showed us, mapping those risks, making them actionable, and then feeding that into the goal. So if the goal is to reduce mold, everybody knows exactly what position they need to take, how that's going to be addressed, and then that's accountable, and it's seen at every level of stakeholders. And it is something that we see that, you know, I suppose the most common problem that we see speaking with organizations, and you know, we have what 98 Paul housing associations at the moment, is they put a lot of effort into documenting the minutes of meetings. They put a lot of effort into getting their Excel right and putting the risks on the Excel and writing down the strategic objectives at the start of the year, saying, yep, let's write them down. But the actions and accountability on the back of that are missing. So that's where we obviously specialise, is in tying up that golden thread. But Paul, I suppose in regards to the housing association, you'd probably be best to pick that up.
Yeah, so as Kieran says, one should precipitate the other. So if we have a meeting, we have key objectives coming out of that. We want to make sure we're recording and tracking those. And likewise, they may have risks attached, which we need to monitor as well. Actually, more recently, one risk manager within the housing sector mentioned to me how useful it was to have a live risk register when he's in these meetings. So you can now see that joined up message that Becky was discussing earlier, whereby they've sent out the risk register, they've sent out the risk reporting, they've provided click of a button reports from our system. Once their board, their audit and risk committee, whoever it might be, are reviewing that during the meeting, they can actually click to see a live version of that as well, because what they had been sent previously might be 2-3 weeks old. They can actually see a live version of that, joining up those dots and running that golden thread through it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that having that kind of risk register that sits on a dusty shelf is something for me that, you know, I'm really averse to when it comes to risk, given my background. And so to be able to have a kind of live there and then risk register for me is quite incredible, really. Quite an incredible aspect.
I think that's all used to drive that culture change. So you may have seen a dusty old risk register sitting on a shelf that people paid lip service to years ago. What we're trying to do is give them the tools to drive that culture change, that everyone can be an individual risk owner, that they don't have to worry about, if you're a risk manager, you don't have to really manage everything on a micro level. you know that you can trust people to manage that within the system, and then you have that top-down overview of it, just in case you need to intervene at any point. I actually think that's becoming more prevalent throughout the sector as well, for a lot of the reasons you discussed earlier. We ran a webinar on Wednesday. Typically, we can expect to see 30 signups, 20 attendees. We had 80 attendees across 118 signups for this one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think that's just a sign of where the sector is at. I've been following up with those calls all morning, and I can tell you that culture change is already happening. The wheels are already in motion. I think what's from the sector risk profile that was published in October, again, that what we discussed at the NatFed Risk Conference in November, I think we're starting to see the resultant change already occurring from that as people get more serious about their risk management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And that's my experience as well. I think that that we have to see that step change. And actually, good news, we are seeing that step change. You know, suddenly there is that kind of focus on having a good risk management framework in place. You know, to make sure that is a comprehensive approach, I suppose, across all of the management of risk and that golden thread or joining of the dots, as I put. Shah, I noticed the other day, actually, you posted on LinkedIn around the mandatory qualified employees piece. Yes. Did you want to just share that with us?
Yeah, so it's been released I think it was last Sunday it was announced, actually.
It was, yeah.
That now about 25,000 managers are expected to be qualified within the housing sector, may that be through, you know, your IH course, whatever that may be, whatever that looks like. And in all honesty, I think it is probably one of the best things that Michael Gove has said in a very, very, very long time. I think it's such a good thing that they've said needs to take place, because let's face it, you know, some people who may have been in housing for an incredibly long time, they do know their stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have that level of qualification that, you know, needs to be in place when we think about the needs that we need to fulfill for the residents and our customers and our tenants at the end of the day. You know, they come first. Quite often they have, you know, a wide range of either vulnerabilities or disabilities or, you know, even just disadvantages that others may not have. So I think it's really, really crucial, and it's a really good way for housing associations to govern their staff and govern what is going on with when we look at, you know, how we can support our residents and our tenants at the heart of it. So again, I think it links back to that culture change.
Yeah, completely. Paul and I were talking about this earlier in the week with Kieran, weren't we? You had quite a view to add.
Let's just say I'll keep my political views to myself. I'll start, and then Paul also had said some views of his own. But you know, there's no disadvantage to obviously additional education. You know, that's clear. I suppose where we see difficulty, you know, we work with the likes of Land Registry. We work with, you know, other sectors, and they get a lot of training and a lot of education, but once that's done, it's trying to keep those disciplines in place, which is quite difficult. So I suppose there needs to be frameworks and, again, software technology that instill the disciplines that they learn and kind of keep that good practice up. So that's the conversation that we had, and it is difficult, and definitely it's not an easy process, but it's a learning curve, and it's, I suppose that's, Paul, you obviously, you know, you were chatting, you had a few good points on it too.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with everything that's been said. I think it ultimately has to be a net positive. Better educated people will lead to better outcomes, I suppose. And that's true of any sector, not just housing. The problems it might introduce, just in terms of how it's financed, you know, we're constantly being told to do more with less. And I just think that better educated people, while that's great, we might have an issue retaining them. We might have an issue with extra recruitment. I think that they may need to be better compensated as well if they're putting a lot of time into educating themselves. Salaries might go up, and that's obviously been a contentious point, trying to gain those salaries recently. So I think it can only be a net positive, but it's just about ironing out everything else that might lead to beyond that.
Yeah, agreed. And I was having a conversation the other day with a director of people in an organization where they were talking about actually they'd geared themselves up for it being a competency-based framework rather than a qualification-based one. And now it seems that we're kind of pivoting on the competency and moving toward the qualification-based. I suppose it's for me, I'm in mixed feelings about it. I feel like there is absolutely benefit in getting good qualifications. I also, though, on the other side of that, know from myself that, you know, I've spent many years in the sector gaining qualifications as I've gone along. Do I really reflect back on those qualifications, or do I actually reflect back on my experience in the sector and, you know, the knowledge that you gain from your peers and, you know, all of that side of it? So I am in mixed feelings. I think it's brilliant when you've got experienced people that bring experience to the table. And I guess that experience will enable them to get qualifications easier, to be able to demonstrate that. But on the other hand, I just think, as you say, not only who's going to fund it, but actually, if we're all relying on the CIH to provide 25,000 managers with qualifications, how the hell are they going to manage that? So
are they going to find the time to do it as well?
Yeah, exactly. You know, just facilitating that is quite epic in its own right, isn't it? So yeah. It will be interesting. It'll be interesting to see what that looks like going forward. Dave's put something in. So have come across this today. Within 6 months of this act receiving royal assent, the Secretary of State must order designate registered providers of social housings for the purpose of Freedom Information Act. Interesting. Let's explore that a little bit more. That's a whole podcast in itself, Char.
I think so, and I think we covered a fair bit of that last time as well, because obviously with the reform bill coming in, there is that Freedom of Information-esque type legislation element. But it isn't FOI. So I've not seen anything about that. Dave, do you have a link or anything as to where you saw that, just so I can do a little bit of research? That might be something I'll be exploring a bit more detail at a later time.
Yeah. Oh, Joe, you make a solid point as well. What does qualified mean? Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. I almost automatically think it's the full on qualification. I think they did talk about level 6 and 7, was it, for senior managers?
I did find it.
I'm going through all the numbers now, aren't I?
Level six.
Around 25,000 managers across the sector will now be required to have an appropriate level housing management qualification regulated by Ofqual, equivalent to a level 4 or 5 certificate or diploma in housing, or a foundation degree from Chartered Institute of Housing.
Oh, wow. So they really are being quite specific, aren't they, about what they mean by that. And James is picking up on the EIR as well. That's going to go hand in hand, isn't it? Oh, thanks, Dave. He's going to try and find that out for us. We've been talking about it. So Paul mentioned the housing FOI again there. We've been talking about this, Paul, for years and years. I can remember the Southwest GDPR group that I was involved in setting up right back at when I probably would have been 2018, I suppose. And we were talking about it then, having a working group with, I don't know if Anthony Ryland, for example, and Christine Chapman are on the call today, but those are absolutely conversations that we were having years ago.
I remember you sent me on a training course because we thought FOI was going to come in.
Yeah.
And that must have been about 4 years ago now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been asked about it quite a lot. Through support desk and through my accounts, and there's not really much more to say at this point. It's been discussions for so long.
I think that point that Shah made around it, you know, the reference to it being what did you call it? FOI-esque. Yeah. I think there's the, you know, already that's moving us toward it in a way that we haven't been moved toward before. And And I guess that leads really well into that kind of, you know, the data quality and systems piece again, because I'm sure everybody in the call knows, but what we're talking about here in terms of the Freedom of Information Act is more around not individual personal data, but data about the business. So this is about gaining information around statistics. So if you live in a block, you know, how many hours cleaning does the cleaning contract give your block, for example, and they, you know, that opens up the floodgates. At the moment, the social housing sector are not required to comply with that, but actually, you know, they might be going forward, and what that actually looks like.
Exactly. And if it is what they've proposed within the, you know, within the reform bill, I think it's important to mention that it is only tenants that would be able to request that information. It isn't the wider public. It would come from customers, essentially. I hate using the term customers for housing, but
I love this. I'm constantly having this debate recently, Shah. The amount of people that go, it's not customers, it's residents, or it's residents, it's not customers. I'm like, oh my gosh, we need a standard terminology, don't we?
I'd say residents.
Residents.
Right. I know they're being provided with a service, but you know, it's not the same to me popping to Boots or whatever.
Yeah, you heard it here first. So Shah has now clarified that for the sector.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Looking from the outside, why has it taken so long, guys? From me looking from the outside, obviously is transparency not a good thing? You know, would it not be better if everybody could see, you know, and then like use that data to compare certain?
It's more complicated than that, Kieran. So the data itself is the easy bit, actually, although I say that flippantly, it's not. It's not the easy bit, but in terms of the whole thing, it is. If we were to move the sector into being compliant with Freedom of Information Act, that would be because we have been designated as a public authority. And as a result of that, means that we then, our debt book goes on the government budgetary system, which means that they look worse than in terms of a financial position than they would have done without us. So that's why they keep us separate in our kind of quasi social housing mode that doesn't come under that kind of local authority, public authority piece. Oh, what does Shane say? Historically, the ICO have past tried to have HA subject to it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is that whole kind of point, really, that that says that if they redesignate us, which they tried to do back in, well, going back now, maybe 2016, uh-huh, something like that. And suddenly they realised that the implications of doing that would have this unwelcome sub-problem.
Side effects, yeah.
Yeah, which is why I think they've included this in the housing reform as that kind of esque bit rather than the full FOI responsibility.
I know a couple of my clients have been approached by the Ombudsman to take part in like a pilot for that exact thing. So I'm interested to see how they do it, what they get asked to do specifically.
Gary said in the chat, one suspects the adoption of an access to information scheme will keep us at arm's length for the government's debt books.
That's so exactly it. Yeah. All of our debt profile goes on to the government's books if we become that public authority piece. So they've got a vested interest in not redesignating us at this stage. So they're trying to get around it in a different way. In a different approach to that, which is interesting. Wow, I think that we've kind of come to the end of our kind of worth update. What's James saying? So worth saying some sites. Yeah,
would you like to read that out for those listening on the catching up later?
Yeah, sure. So James says it's worth saying that if someone cites EIR as the basis of a request, and it's applied to the housing association, then there is much more restricted range of options to apply exemptions, exclusions. So FRI will be Sorry, so FOI will be troublesome, but EIR will be potentially more so. Yeah, yeah, that's my understanding, absolutely. And then apparently a new clause 6 of the bill read on Wednesday. Oh, and we've got a link.
Ooh.
Ah, okay, I haven't picked that up. Thank you for that, Dave, that's really helpful. Bit of bedtime reading there, folks, I think. Perfect. So I think we've probably covered everything, haven't we, Shah? Am I missing anything today?
Unless you wanted to look at the wider risks. We've touched on little bits and pieces, but we've not necessarily delved in a bit, have we?
That's true. And actually, one of the things that we've been looking at more recently is that kind of what do the top 10 risks look like within the housing sector at the moment, particularly for 2023, which is interesting because it feels like it's the same old list that's kind of rehashed around a little bit. And I guess both from Kieran and Paul's perspective, you're going to see quite a lot of risk registers within the sector, given what you do. But, that we talked about that kind of health and safety risk and the fire safety, building safety, all of that piece. There's loads of risk around the compliance, the top 6, as they call them, the gas, lift and safety, electric testing, etc. That budgetary constraints that we're in at the moment, the funding cuts that we're seeing, the now resolved, but lots of uncertainty around the rent increase that we saw. And I'm always banging on about the reputation risk, that kind of, that whole trust and transparency piece. So the reputation, trust and transparency is the way I like to look at it now, rather than just reputation in its own right, because reputation is one thing, but actually it's about how does that reputation then lead through to people and the transparency of the organisation and the trust that they can have in the organisation. And then I saw the other day quite a lot around resident behaviour as a risk now around, the which I hadn't seen pop
that's,
up.
That's not recently. One that I've come across either.
No, that antisocial behaviour and also things like rent arrears, I suppose, that you could link that to behaviour and around that kind of reform piece, the cost of living, I guess.
Exactly. Well, with the cost of living, I wouldn't be surprised if, residents falling into arrears has gone up by a massive percentage. It's not something that's, been flagged directly by my clients to me, but, from working in the sector, know what the percentage was like a couple of years ago, and then you look at where it is today. I mean, even with, anyone and everyone, so many people I know have fallen behind on different bills, may it be, council tax or utility, because it's just through the roof at the moment.
Totally agree.
I can't speak from any empirical standpoint on that one in terms of percentages, but I can say that I do speak with people within the sector every day, and that does seem to be one that's popping up more and more and more often. So I think it is a sign of the times as well, but it's just one that's probably going to have a lot more emphasis in the coming months.
I'm really interested in it, kind of as that description that I saw, that resident behaviour risk was how they badged it, and that actually that included elements of things like the antisocial behaviour versus rent arrears and the impacts of cost of living. And then of course we see the and I would be in the wrong place if I wasn't talking about the data protection risks. They continue. So around that, breaches of data privacy and all of that piece and cyber. I had a really interesting conversation the other day actually with some guys that are putting together a live event for us for the Housing GRC conference, and that's very much around that cybersecurity risk piece, and actually how we respond to that as organisations, because the learning that can happen from organisations that have experienced cyber breaches is absolutely critical, I think. And then the last two I've got in my top 10 are inevitably the environmental list, risk around the net zero targets that we've got, the climate change energy efficiency piece, And then the political risk around changes in government policy and uncertainty around funding. And my goodness, we've talked about loads of the political risks in the session today, for sure. And I suppose the last thing that I didn't add to this mix was, and that I wanted to, was around the tone at the top. You know, the organisation and how the senior managers in the organisation have a responsibility to kind of, you know, demonstrate that tone at the top, what that means in the organisation.
Yeah, I think quite often, thinking more historically through working in a housing association, you can see where the culture was and where it is shifted to, and there definitely has been a big change. And, you know, the people at the top are definitely setting that tone and are setting that level. But sometimes it just feels like it's just been a little bit too slow to hit that mark to where we should be.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I'm always banging on about in terms of that tone at the top from a risk perspective. But actually, you know, everything that we're talking about, you know, how much autonomy are they giving people that are advising the business around data and data quality, data management, dealing with breaches, you know, really pulling in on the experience, those kind of attitudes and behaviours of senior leaders really set the tone, don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's actually one area.
Sorry,
go ahead, Jess.
That's the same with data protection in general as well. You know, if there's that culture from the top, then, you know, you can push it through into the roots, but it's difficult trying to, you know, implement proper processes and procedures and things like that.
I have that buy-in.
It's usually a lack of awareness that it comes down to. You know, as soon as you throw a few real cases in there, then the alarm bells ring, the risk register comes out. And it's to take it from there. So,
and I guess the unfortunate side of that, Jazz, is that organisations that have experienced some of those negatives, their behaviours are probably quite different to those that are getting away with it to that point.
Yeah, definitely.
There's nothing like a real life example, is there?
I know. What was it?
Just that the tone of the top quite often can get lost in translation if you don't have the right frameworks and structures in place to carry it through. So we find a lot of the time that people will begin with a message of they want to improve their risk management, or indeed they want to get back to adhering to their strategic report, the strategic objectives over the course of the next year, 2 years, 3 years. But in actual fact, when they go to put these things into practice, they don't have the necessary tools to do so. And ultimately, it just ends up in the back burner somewhere. So again, that's where we find that particularly our technology can help set the goals, monitor them, make sure there's accountability, visibility of those goals, and that message that started with initially, the whole new year, new me type message that we so often see, that that's actually carried through and it is not abandoned halfway through.
Yeah,
no, that's
definitely a really
good point. You know, especially when the GDPR came into effect, A lot of things were done, a lot of processes were implemented, documentation created at the time that since, you know, it's not been assigned to people, you know, senior managers or people within certain departments to keep that information up to date. And for example, records of process and activities, the amount of ones that we see that were created in 2018 and they've not been touched since, because there aren't people with a responsibility throughout every level of the business. It's just
Yeah. And how often have those processes changed, or, you know, those process owners moved on? They may not even be within the organisation anymore.
Yeah.
So it's keeping those little things up to date.
Yeah. And not just that, we often see that if one thing is assigned to three or four different people, well, ultimately nothing changes. No one actually takes it up because they're always expecting somebody else to look at it. Whereby if you can assign these things with that clear responsibility and accountability, there's nowhere for people to hide. It's there. If they move on, they have to assign that to somebody else before they move on. And it goes from being lip service to actually being put into practice.
Yeah, I think one way to tackle that is to assign these responsibilities to a job role rather than an individual. Like you say, Charlotte, when people leave an organisation, it leaves with them, or it goes, you know, into hiding.
Exactly.
Until the panic sets. So
you know, job roles change and evolve as well. So how often do we see it where a job role existed and now you look back and think,
yeah,
what on earth was that? What team did that fall under? I don't even know what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you don't have a clear and concise process of documenting that and assigning that out, you can see how quickly and how easily these things get left behind, how quickly they're forgotten about.
Yeah, that corporate memory loss, definitely. Yeah.
Definitely.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to pull us together then with some key takeaways, if I may.
Cool.
So really useful session again today. Thank you ever so much for everybody that's joined us and absolutely from our guests, which is really, really, really good. We've kind of done a full circle, done a full loop, I think, today around that governance, risk and compliance, you know, really talking about that as essential components, really, for our effective social housing management within the sector, for sure. And actually, with that premise that we're all here to keep our residents safe and that the services are of high quality and that the resources are used responsibly, you know, within those organisations. And I suppose that was useful linking that in then to the developing of that golden thread, that governance, risk and compliance thread through the business, implementing those frameworks and cultures and having the right tools in place that, you know, really support the effective risk management and compliance, the kind of, you know, the under the bonnet stuff of the organisation, as I like to call it. And then that really controversial piece that Shah brought to the table for us today was useful as well around the qualified employees and, you know, are they essential for the effective governance of the organisation? Only time will tell, I suppose, on that basis. So thank you, Jazz. Over to you, I think, to close us off.
No, thank you for a great session. For anybody listening, we do have a group on LinkedIn called Data Protection in Housing, run by data protection people. So if you want to join that, search that, or you can send us an email if you want to, if you need further information around it. And yeah, I'll see you all at the GRC event. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you everyone for your time and to our special guests. It's been a great session.
Brilliant.
Thanks very much, folks. See you
later. Bye.
Bye.